is Nicholas Webb, and I'm standing in today for Trudy, who is taking some very badly time needed to get off and relax and do her thing. For those of you who don't know me, I am an author of the book The Cost of Being Sick, which was first written back in 2002. And then we just came out with a new edition this year, so by all means, it's available at all of your bookstores, The Cost of Being Sick at Barnes & Noble. So, I've spent my life as a medical technologist developing technologies, and today with me here today, somebody who I have a lot in common with, because I started my career selling foldable intraocular lenses for Star Surgical 6 years ago. Thanks. And we have Dr. Dan Linsink with us today, who is a board-certified ophthalmologist who specializes in ophthalmic plastic surgery.
Good morning, Nick. Hey, can you spell ophthalmic plastic surgery?
It's funny. Actually, I had that come up a couple days ago, and I'm going, can I remember this? So what we want to talk a little bit about is healthcare and the future of healthcare. Both of us have very strong opinions in that regard, and we also want to talk a little bit about what Dr. Linsink does here in town and about you know, the benefits that you can derive from some of his procedures, which are really interesting. So I think that we should start out by maybe talking about what the future of healthcare looks like based on the current trajectory. That seems to be a good place to start. I know that's a loaded question, but what's your take on where we're heading?
Well, the only thing I can tell you for sure is that it's going to change and it needs to change, and hopefully it'll change for the better, but there's going to be some lumps along the way before things get to where they need to be. I know that there's a lot of national debate out there about the healthcare reform legislation and whether it should be dumped or not. The answer is going to lie somewhere in the middle. There are some good things in the healthcare reform legislation. There are some bad things, and it really needs to be worked out.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that in researching my book that I was surprised to see, and I don't think I've really seen anybody refute this, is that the disease processes that are caused by diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, which are almost completely precipitous of obesity, are escalating so quickly, and our ability as a country to create enough wealth to mitigate the cost of that, most people say that those lines intersect at about 3 or 4 years down the road. Most optimistic numbers I've seen is 8 years, to where literally we are having sort of Department of Motor Vehicle levels of health care, where people come into this very sterile clinic, they get the minimal amount of care. And it's really pretty bleak, and I have not found a piece of data to suggest anything really to the contrary.
Well, you're pointing at a painful truth. There just isn't enough resource available in this country or any other country to really finance all the health care that everybody wants, and something's going to have to change. One of my concerns has been that we doctors and all providers are really paid to treat illness. No one's out there making a living preventing illness. It's an up-and-coming thing. I know your book is directed at that. But as the system changes and evolves, it's going to have to change more towards a preventive illness model rather than an intervene after the illness already occurred model.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think in the ideal world, what I'd like to see is wellness gatekeepers that are physicians that have a philosophy of integrated healthcare that they can pull a variety of levers from conventional allopathic healthcare to preventative. I mean, right now, if you go to a doctor and you're overweight and you have really, really high cholesterol and you're hypertensive, chances are they're going to start writing really quickly some scripts and get you out the door, when in fact, according to the research that I did in my book, and it ranges from 85% to well over 90% of the cost associated with healthcare are directly driven by lifestyle changes. So what's amazing to me is we're not dealing with causality. That just blows my mind. We have all this talk about how we're going to provide more treatment intervention, but nobody's really talking about the root cause.
I think that's based in how insurance was developed. You know, originally people didn't have insurance. They went to the doctor and they paid for it themselves, and the cost of healthcare became more complicated, and then it became more expensive, and we sort of had to start sharing our resources to cover the cost of healthcare. And it was only intended to cover the things that people couldn't pay for. Going to the doctor to have your blood pressure checked was no big deal, but when you ended up needing heart surgery, that was a big deal. So health insurance was really directed at covering the cost of expensive health care and never was directed at preventing us from becoming sick in the first place. And as I mentioned earlier, that's really what needs to change. And you're right, there really isn't much of that going on.
One thing I'd like to do for the listeners is to kind of give them the landscape of what it looks like. In other words, who's going to suffer and who's going to benefit from these changes? And I'd like to address that as soon as we get back from this break.
Today,
okay, we're back from the break with Dr. Dan Linsink, a local board-certified ophthalmologist. Yeah, it's funny, I've spent so much time in ophthalmology. Dan and I have had a lot of great discussions about the where we've been and where we're heading. You know, one of the things that is really surprising to me when I speak on the area of healthcare and preventative wellness is how there is this misconception that the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and the, as they put it, fat cat doctors are making tons of money. And as long as we can change how much money we give them, we'll be able to provide copious amounts of fantastic health care to the rest of the world. Do you want to recalibrate us on that?
Sure, I'd love to. First of all, I think when the government and people are buying things, the goal is to pay as little for it as you can. When you go buy a car, you negotiate for it. And when the city hires firefighters or police officers, they pay as little as they can. And when the government pays doctors for Medicare, they ought to pay as little as they can. And the definition of not paying enough is when you don't have enough people around to do it. And this community has lost several dozen physicians over the last two or three, 4 years. Reimbursement compared to the regulatory issues is just causing doctors to leave. So things are really not the same. They're getting much worse.
Yeah, you know, and the bottom line is that patients will ultimately mitigate a lot of the burden of the changes in healthcare. They will take a lot of the body blow. They'll have longer waits, reduction in access to certain healthcare programs. And I think ultimately, if you fast forward this thing, it gets almost frightening to see how much of a reduction in the quality of care that will be that'll be doled out. And unfortunately, a lot of people have been successfully persuaded to believe that there is all this extra fluff, especially on the healthcare provider side.
Right. You know, Medicare has been cutting reimbursement for quite a few years now. It can be cut a little more, I'm sure, but there isn't a lot of more room to cut the physicians. There was a day when physicians were overpaid. I think that day is gone. I am not a fan of health insurance carriers. I don't want to be thought of as a fan of health insurance carriers. But when you look at the amount of money they keep and don't hand out in healthcare delivery, it's not that much money. It's probably 10 or 12%. And while I'm angry with health insurance carriers, and I've dealt with them for years and have a lot of examples of where they've been, in my opinion, very inappropriate, they don't have a lot of fluff to hand out either. I suppose you can take some profit out of the health insurance carriers, out of the drug companies and whatnot, but it's not really going to solve the problem.
Absolutely. Once again, we're here with Positively Healthy, KCRN 1460. I've got Dr. Dan Linsink, a local board-certified ophthalmologist and plastic surgeon. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the kinds of things that you do in your practice, specifically on the more positive side of this show. But we did want to kind of take advantage of the fact that we've had this discussion so many times ourselves that we thought it would be a good idea to share sort of the reality of this. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of people are not clear on is the fact that, again, as much as 90% of the cause, or that is 90% of the cost associated with healthcare is directly associated with lifestyles. Now, there was this big movement to let's get another 15 million people on healthcare. When I lecture, I tell people there's one thing they need to understand. We do not have a healthcare crisis in this country. I repeat, we do not have a healthcare crisis in this country. What we have is a health crisis, and that's a very different thing. There's been several studies that suggest that when you add as little as $5 on a copay, that you significantly reduce the amount of utilization. The idea right now is that the average American is under the erroneous impression that they are allowed to eat their way into obesity, or more specifically, chronic disease, and then demand that somebody bails them out through treatment intervention, and the bottom line is, it doesn't work. And I know that you see this in your practice, and so what do? Rather than changing the root causality, we go after the people that provide the health care, we go after the pharmaceutical companies, the device companies, and I believe personally that that is a bad strategy.
You know, Nick, you mentioned that 90% of the money that goes into healthcare is for something that could have been prevented, and I wouldn't believe it if I didn't know it was true. That is an astounding number. It's just hard to believe that lifestyle causes that much illness. But it's a scientific fact. It's not Nick's generalization. From skin cancer to obesity, most of what goes on in the doctor's office is something that could have and should have been prevented. And that's really where the savings needs to come from. And I think we all want to be healthier anyway.
Yeah, and you know, the idea that you can be healthy through treatment intervention is oftentimes misguided. You know, I can remember as a medical technologist being in the boardroom and listening to people talk about how can we create long-term addictive forms of pharmacological intervention. In other words, let's not develop a 10-day, or let's not create Zithromax and put somebody on antibiotics for 3 to 5 days. Let's create something that they have to be on the rest of their life. And let's create counter-indicational uses. Let's now all of a sudden, if you're depressed because of PMS, let's put you on Prozac for the rest of your life. And I just, we are too quick to pull the pharmacy and the intervention trigger, and that's the other side of it. My colleagues in the pharmaceutical and medical device space they're opportunistic. They're business people. They're looking for ways to make money intervening in the self-destructive behaviors of America. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. But I do know that's the theater, and that's what we have to work with. You don't fix the problem by increasing, and I know this sounds really shocking to people, you don't fix healthcare by increasing your access to treatment intervention. You fix healthcare, and this has to be done this way from an economy point of view, you fix healthcare by reducing the need to access treatment intervention, right?
I think you're 100% correct, and I think that what the healthcare delivery system needs to do is change and re-incentivize providers for the kind of care that they give. Let me just give you an example. You know, Mercy Medical Center benefits when people end up in the hospital with out-of-control congestive heart failure. Nothing against Mercy, but that's what they get paid to do, is treat inpatients. If they could be part of a system that would allow them to be reimbursed for helping to keep people healthy so they never got out of control congestive heart failure, everybody would be a lot better off. People wouldn't be as ill. There wouldn't be as much money going into health care. And one of the good things going on with health care reform is to try and re-incentivize doctors and medical centers to work together to keep people out of the hospital, to keep them healthy.
Okay, well, listen, we're right now at Trudy Pratt's Positively Healthy Show with Dr. Dan Lensing. We're also going to take some calls if anybody's interested, wants to pick a fight with us. We're ready to roll. It's 605-4567. And you're listening to KCNR 1460.
Do you have...
This is Nicholas Webb. I'm sitting in for Trudy Pratt's Positively Healthy Show at KCNR 1460, and I've got Dr. Dan Lensing, a local board-certified ophthalmologist with me. I almost said orthopedic surgeon, but I don't know. Probably wouldn't do it as good as you do your do eyes. We want to talk just a little bit more, kind of wrap up our thoughts on healthcare and sort of the lay of the land, and then I'd like to talk a little bit more about what you do, and which I think is fascinating. I wish I was smart enough to do the kind of stuff you do. It's very, very interesting.
You're way smarter than I am.
I teed that up perfectly, right? So, you know, I think the bottom line is this, is that there are people that that have conditions that they didn't sign up for, cancers and injury and a variety of other things. And really our message, I think, is one of compassion, that if we want to provide healthcare intervention, we want to provide treatment intervention in the way of, you know, emergency health care and interventional health care for non-self-destructive disease processes, I really think that, I know that the data is clear, that we need to stop the gratuitous usage of health care just to be able to eat an extra double cheeseburger, right?
I think you're 100% correct. You know, I like your term. What was that? The illness you didn't sign up for, that's a great term. So many people do suffer from illnesses that they didn't cause, wasn't their fault, and, you know, the system needs to be able to support those people. Compassion does need to be the rule, and it would be so much easier if we prevented the illness we could before it happened.
Yeah, and I talk about in my book that, you know, if you really care about somebody, and if a country really cares about their people, what we really want to do is, and I think the government may have a role in providing education and access to resources to really help people stay well. Because the best gift you can give somebody is not treatment intervention, it's wellness. And again, this idea of adding 15 million more people to sign up for more gratuitous treatment intervention, I just feel very strongly is misguided.
There's so much truth to that. As long as we do sort out, you know, preventing what we can and treating what genuinely needs to be treated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and again, I'm not, just my, me personally, I'm not big on automatically pulling the government trigger here. But I do think that, again, if the government does have a role in healthcare, it might be providing preventative healthcare. I think that makes a lot more sense than them being involved in treatment intervention. And it is a wonderful gift to help people. You know, the example that I give is that if you were to put your child in a car seat and you drove around after drinking a six-pack of beer in a busy city street, the likelihood of inflicting an injury on your child is less than the almost certainty that you will, through dietary modeling, reduce the span of your child's life. In fact, there was a study through the National Institutes of Health that proved that one in every three children are on their way to adult-onset diabetes as a result of poor dietary modeling, and that's just part of it. According to a recent Harris poll, over 80% of Americans are overweight. We know that obesity is the driving force for all illness. We're on the wrong path. We can't fix healthcare by throwing more money we don't have at it. Through treatment intervention, we've got to deal with causality.
You know, Nick, I think I need to take a break and go run about 5 miles and come back. I'm feeling a little bit overweight right now.
Yeah.
You're making me feel guilty. Well, you know, the federal government is, through this new healthcare legislation, promoting a new concept called an accountable care organization, Accountable Care Organization, or ACO, wherein physicians and medical centers are being incentivized to work together to try and reduce the cost of healthcare, and that's going to be through catching illness before it gets bad or before it happens. So I think things are, I just hope that things are going to move in the right direction. They may get worse before they get better, but they have to get better, and I think that there are a few good things going on that are going to move things in the direction you're discussing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, let's talk about some fun stuff here. I started in ophthalmology a quarter of a century ago, which is frightening when I think about that. And the big buzz...
He was eight when he started.
Yeah, right. The buzz back then, of course, was small incision, foldable intraocular lenses. And I had a great time getting involved in the first intraocular lenses that actually get folded up and inserted into the eye, so you didn't have to do a big 10-millimeter incision to deliver the nucleus, you know, in whole. So you'd get less postoperative astigmatism, you'd have better healing, just a lot better procedure. You know, ophthalmology is, you know, obviously built a great deal. There's some wonderful things going on, obviously, with refractive surgery. I was involved with Ron Jensen, one of the founders of refractive surgery in the United States. So ophthalmology is a very, very interesting area. It's very dear to my heart. I've spent my entire involved with ophthalmic products. Where are we heading in terms of, generally speaking, in terms of, are there any new things on the, we're going to talk specifically about the plastic side, but do you see anything on the horizon that's new and pending in the ophthalmology technology side?
Well, I have to go back and start from the beginning from my point of view. And trace maybe where we've gotten a little bit. I'm the son of an ophthalmologist. I remember going to the hospital with my dad day after day after day, sitting in the car playing in the hospital parking lot while he was rounding on patients, and he was an ophthalmologist. And these days, ophthalmologists don't even go to the hospital. Yeah. But in the early 1960s, cataract surgery involved making a big, huge slice in the eye and taking out this lens and putting people in the intensive care unit with sandbags.
Yeah,
on both sides of their head.
Yeah.
for a week,
right.
Before they went home. And then they got these ugly Coke bottle glasses. Yeah. And it wasn't a very good operation. But today, literally, the incision is 3.2 millimeters wide. It's so small it rarely needs to even be stitched. Yeah. Due to people like you, some pretty incredible things have been invented, like foldable intraocular lenses, so you can literally fold a lens to fit it in that little teeny tiny hole, and things have really gotten better. There is no new, nothing that exciting on the forefront. There are all kinds of things out there to treat macular degeneration and whatnot, and a lot of what's going on these days is really directed probably more at diseases like that than anything else, diseases of the retina. But there's a lot of neat things that have happened, and there are new things on the forefront, but nothing really outstanding that just is going to get anybody really excited.
Okay, well, when we get back, we're going to talk about what you do, and I think is I've got a lot of great questions for you on that. So we're going to talk about what you do. I'm with Nicholas Webb. I'm sitting in for Trudy Pratt and her Positively Healthy show on KCNR 1460.
What do you look for in a...
Sitting in for Trudy Pat on Positively Healthy Show at KCNR 1460 with Dr. Dan Linsink, a local board-certified orthopedic surgeon. And I have to admit, for the sake of fair disclosure, he's a good friend. So we got a caller right now, and we're going to take see if we can take a call right now.
Hi, Dan.
Hello. What can we do for you?
Hi. Dr. Dan, does a prospective patient like myself need a referral from my optometrist? I'm in Reading.
You know, I didn't have my headphones on when you started that question. Would you ask me that again, please?
Well, a prospective patient like myself who has an optometrist, I'm 66 and diabetic, and I'm experiencing a little black, they said it was detached retina, and I'm concerned because I know this disease, if uncontrolled, and I'm trying to control it as best I can, but it's hereditary. So, Do we need a referral to come see you?
Well, for starters, I don't treat diabetic retinopathy. The next thing we were going to talk about was going to be the plastic surgery of the eyes that I do. But if you have a detached retina, that's considered a medical emergency. That needs to be dealt with right away. It doesn't sound to me like the spots you're seeing are necessarily a detached retina. It's probably not, especially if you're a diabetic. But you should see... your optometrist or an ophthalmologist in the reasonably near future to deal with that matter.
And well, I go in annually, but I went into Silverstein to make sure that nothing was really radically wrong. When someone mentioned detached retina, that was my regular optometrist, and he said it was aging and not to be concerned. But when you hear that, it did concern me, so I made an appointment with Silverstein, and he said, oh, he wasn't concerned about it. It was little tiny black dots that I sort of see. Do I need a referral? And what doctor can I go to?
Well, for starters, Dr. Bruce Silverstein is a phenomenal ophthalmologist. I trust him intrinsically. He's taken care of my own family members, and I trust his opinion.
I trusted his opinion, too, so I guess it is
I don't think
they said it was the disease of aging and because of the diabetes.
I think he probably told you that you had a vitreous detachment, not a retinal detachment.
What kind of a detachment?
A detachment of the vitreous, not the retina. It's what causes these common floaters that almost all of us have when we get to be our ages.
Okay.
So you probably have a vitreous detachment, not a retinal detachment.
A vitreous detachment.
And that's not a problem. It's an annoyance because of those floaters it causes, but it's not a problem. Here again, I trust Dr. Silverstein's opinion intrinsically.
I do, too. I felt safe after I saw him, but those little black... That was changes in my vision, those little black floaters.
Did you say
so annually, you think, keep an eye on it? Just annually with my optometrist is good enough?
Yeah, uh-huh. All the optometrists in this town are excellent.
Yes, they are. Dr. Cooper is my...
Yeah,
Cooper
I know him personally, too, and I would trust him to do the right thing.
Yes, I just love
your
him.
Eyes.
Did you say your... it's a vitreal detachment.
Yeah, did you say you're a diabetic?
Yes.
In a diabetic, we're somewhat more concerned because of diabetic retinopathy. So when something changes or is different, you need to see Dr. Cooper right away. But if it's the same that you've been having and it's been evaluated by Dr. Silverstein, I wouldn't worry.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye. All right. So I kind of set you up for that. Well, you actually... are involved. One of the main areas of your practice is blepharoplasties,
right.
And maybe you could describe that, and so we can bring that into focus.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I am a board-certified ophthalmologist or eye surgeon, but as advances in medical care have gone as they have over the last several decades, even ophthalmologists have become subspecialized, and I specialize in ophthalmic plastic surgery. I did a residency in ophthalmology. I went on to do fellowship training in plastic surgery of the eyes. So I do cosmetic and reconstructive surgery of the area around the eyes, the eyelids, the tear ducts, and the eye socket. And, yes, blepharoplasty is kind of my favorite thing to do.
Now, there are two ways to look at that generally. One is medically necessary when it's into your in your optical field or causing vision problems, right? And then some of it can be just cosmetic.
Correct. Different insurance carriers have different criteria that need to be met to determine what they call medical necessity. Some require photographs, some require photographs and visual field testing, but if an insurance carrier is going to cover the procedure, it needs to be done for a health care reason, and that's loss of field of vision or visual fatigue from raising your eyebrows to get the eyelid skin out of the way.
You know, it does have an amazing cosmetic effect. I mean, people that have just a little bit of extra skin on their upper eyelid, they look tired and they just, they look old. And what when I see people that have had blepharitis, I'm surprised just how much better it makes them look.
You know, it sounds kind of melodramatic to say it, but I really do sort of believe that the eyes are the windows to the soul. When we do our training, we all go through the same rigmarole. We use the same rules about how to do things, and then we modify it over time, kind of in an artistic kind of a way. And I like the way I do blepharoplasties. I have a goal of getting a natural result. I'm insulted if somebody notices that one of my patients had their lids done. I just want them to look at them and think, you're looking good, but I don't know why. So that's the fun part of it for me.
Now, in some cases, though, it can be pretty dramatic to where it's actually dropping down into the eye and causing a very conspicuous problem in terms of their visual field.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, that happens, and that's when insurance carriers do cover the procedure.
You know, one of the things I like about your practice, well, first of all, again, Dan's a good friend of mine, and I appreciate in all aspects of your life precision. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see people that do things with tremendous precision, that's who you want to choose as your healthcare provider. And I actually went to your practice and had you look at my eyelids. I'm 52. And you said, you know, don't do it. And, you know, that's a hard thing for somebody in healthcare to say, to not do something when it's you typically not covered by insurance. And I appreciate the honesty in which you run your practice and also the precision. I mean, it's incredible. Your staff, your office, it's just an amazing operation.
Well, thanks, Nick. I appreciate the compliment. You know, you talk about precision. I refer to myself as being anal retentive, and I'm proud of it.
Well, you know, that's a good thing when you're talking about somebody that's going to take a sharp object to your eyelid, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, you do some other things in your practice as well in terms of resurfacing. So maybe you could just kind of give me a lay of the land of the other things that you provide in your menu of services.
Well, there's the cosmetic eyelid surgery. Another thing that falls under the cosmetic category is laser resurfacing. I know that that's pretty hot on the market these days, and I get a little defensive about it because I feel like some people just go out there and buy a laser and start firing away, kind of as a way to supplement their income. I first got involved with laser resurfacing in about 1995 because when people have wrinkles around their eyes they want removed, tightening the skin doesn't always work because it can pull the eyelid away from the eyeball and cause some problems. So I started getting involved in lasering the area around the eyes and have extended it from there. So I have a good 15 years of experience doing laser skin rejuvenation. That's a fun thing to do.
You know, the results are amazing, but what a lot of people don't know, I remember being at the American Academy of Ophthalmology back in, gosh, maybe it was the mid-90s, and everybody was buying, you know, YAGs and CO2s, and there was the laser du jour at every booth with the idea of bringing in these other capabilities for standard ophthalmologists. But I remember talking to a plastic surgeon, and she said what they're not realizing is that this is a painful procedure that does require a lot of convalescence, and most people are not really prepared for what that means in terms of pain and recovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have to thank my wife for this one. Maureen, are you out there listening? When I first started doing laser resurfacing, it really was a painful thing. It was miserable for me. It was miserable for the patients. I didn't like doing it. They were eating Vicodin like candy, and I tried everything recommended for treatment from bovine collagen masks to whatever. The one thing I didn't have the nerve to try was Preparation H. But I finally turned to my wife, who I actually met in a burn center. She's a critical care burn nurse, and we started using burn techniques, and it is not a painful thing now. The recovery for laser rejuvenation takes about 8 days for the wounds to heal in and a few months for the skin to really return to a normal appearance. But it is not a painful thing these days using typical burn center techniques for treating the wounds.
All right, that's great. Well, listen, we're going to take another break. This is Nicholas Webb. I'm sitting in for Trudy Pat. You're listening to KCNR 1460. Welcome back. You're listening to KCNR 1460. I've got Dr. Dan Linsink, a board-certified orthopedic surgeon and also a good friend. We're here talking about blefs and laser surgery and various ways to look and feel better. What have I missed?
Well, during the break, I was just complimenting you on how good you are, seem to be doing at this, but I'm an ophthalmologist, not an orthopedic surgeon.
Did I say that? You know, I'm involved in a couple orthopedic products right now, so I just keep on wanting you to be an orthopedic surgeon.
You know, you said you were going to do that, Nick, and you did.
Yeah, I did. Isn't that great?
I'm not sure what Nick isn't involved in healthcare. He invents stuff. He's written a book.
Yeah.
So what are we going to talk about
okay,
now?
Okay, so, you know, one of the things that that when I lecture on prevention and wellness on my book, The Cost of Being Sick, it's interesting that I can look out into the audience and you definitely can see people who are living a healthy lifestyle. They look better. That it turns out that healthy is one of the best ways to look better. And I know that, you know, some of the causes of aging result in sagging skin and some of it does require surgical and other types of treatment intervention. But are there, you know, I mean, is hydration, are there other things that you, when you're talking to your patients about ways that they can maintain a more healthy look?
You know, I can't claim credit for this way of describing it. 10 years or so ago, I went to a national conference and heard a dermatologist talk about the aging skin. And she said, go home and look in the mirror, look at your face, and then look at your fanny in the mirror. And what's the difference? You know, they have the same parents. Your fanny and your face have the same parents. They're both the same age. What is the difference between your fanny and your face? And the real difference is one is seeing a whole lot of ultraviolet light, and in most cases, the other one hasn't seen hardly any ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is the big bad thing for the face. It causes the things we treat, you know, skin cancer all the time, but it has a lot of other effects too. And probably one of the most significant that we don't think about is it decreases the elastin layer in the skin. And leads to our face having more of the lack of elasticity like a worn-out bathing suit might have.
Yeah.
And the best way to prevent the aging process is to just keep your face out of the sun.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
It's kind of been overstated perhaps, but it still remains true. You know, I judiciously put sunscreen on my face every single day for about a week.
Ah.
And then I get over it for 9 months, but, you know, we all need to do better at that.
Especially up here where everybody's boating and skiing and hiking. And, you know, that makes me feel a little concerned. I mean, I spent 6 years as a lifeguard, and I used to put baby oil on my face to get my face.
I think it was called suntan lotion back then.
Yeah, right. Oh, my goodness. And it obviously is not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I in my book, I talk about, you know, some of these different things you can do. One of the things that I have put together is sort of the shopping list of things, and I'd like to get your take on this. One is hydration. It's amazing. I just listened to an online lecture last week about the carbonated beverage addictions that we have and the way in which it does the opposite of hydration. But just drinking lots of water, getting at least eight hours of sleep, exercising for at least 20 minutes a day, reducing your amounts of fats, and trying to make sure you balance your proteins and your carbohydrates on the health side. And it's amazing if you can do those things. I know it's hard, but the sleep, the water, the good diet, the daily exercise, and I also supplement with, I look at the vitamin regimen as it probably can't kill me and it might actually help. So, I mean, you know, that's sort of how I look at dietary supplements. But what's your take on that roundup?
We forgot to mention we're supposed to floss twice a day.
Ah, right, yeah, right.
You know, I kind of think, once I do all the weightlifting I'm supposed to do and the cardio exercise and the stretching, I don't have time to go to work when I'm doing all those other things. But doing the lifestyle changes, making the right, changing the habits, it isn't that big a deal once you've set into motion new ways of living. And, you know, we all need to do better. I'm guilty. But I think you're hitting the nail right on the head. Gosh, I'm going to have to jog home now and drink all those Diet Pepsis. But clearly, we could all be better off.
Yeah. Well, and it does have it definitely does have an effect. I mean, we begin the program talking about the need to not be overweight and the need to deal with the root cause of healthcare. So I wanted to dole that up there because, you know, in my own life, I've been a vegetarian now for almost 40 years. I exercise every day. I climb up with a group of guys. Up to the top of the mountain. You know my family. We're family, friends, and I think you can agree that I practice what I preach.
You know, I think you most certainly do. I'm trying to practice what you preach. I'm not always that good at it. My wife laughs at me because I decide I'm going to do something, and I'll go jog 10 miles after I haven't jogged 10 miles for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then I'll cause a shin splint, so I'll get on the exercise bike and cause some kind of another injury. I was talking with a friend of mine, an anesthesiologist in town, Tom Thomas, who is into ultra athletic events. I'm talking the things that go for 8 days. And kind of complaining about my aches and pains and shin splints and plantar fasciitis.
Yeah.
And pulled this and bumpy that. And his recommendation was that we all need to increase our exercise, but there's a way to do it. And he limits himself to 10% per week.
Wow.
So if he wants to, right now he's getting ready to run in some event that he feels like he needs to run 30 miles a week to be ready for, and he's only running 15, so he's increasing his mileage by 10% per week to get to 30 without injuring himself. And I'm being told we got to go to a break.
Yeah, so we'll take a break right now, and we'll wrap this up when we get back. You're listening, this is Nicholas Webb. I'm sitting in for Trudy Pratt. You're listening to KCNR 1460. This is Nicholas Webb, and I'm sitting in for Trudy Pratt today at KCNR 1460. We've got board certified, here it is, ophthalmologist. I got it right this time, Dr. Dan Linsink.
If I sound out of breath, I went and ran around the block during the break.
You know, I should talk. My only real vice is every once in a while, I'll have one or two Sierra Nevada pale ale beers, and I just love them, but they're... You know, they're empty calories, and I probably don't need to do that, but that's about as bad as I think I get. You know?
Well, I have so many vices that I don't think we have time to talk about them because the show's going to end pretty soon.
Yeah.
I'm not going to admit to them either.
Well, with our last break here, I guess maybe we should do some takeaways here. So I hope the listeners realize, or at least consider pondering the idea that maybe the way in which we view healthcare reform or healthcare in general possibly is wrong. That it's not about demanding more treatment intervention, especially when we know through every healthcare futurist that the economic wealth creation is not nearly as great as the increased cost associated with the epidemiology of the disease process, primarily driven by obesity. So we know that we just can't do it. So it's not a matter we should have more access. We just simply don't have the resources. And I think that's one misnomer that we need to address. And the other one is that don't kid yourself. The lie that's being propagated that the fat cat doctors, the fat cat insurance companies, the fat cat pharmaceutical companies are going to take all of the body blow of these changes in healthcare is just absolutely a fantasy. It is going to adversely affect every American.
You take all the profit out of all the providers of healthcare, there still isn't enough money left to fix all the problems.
There really isn't.
Prevention, incentivizing providers and incentivizing the utilizers of healthcare to prevent illness is really the best way to move forward.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's not as brandable. You know, it's really hard to brand get off the couch. It's really hard to tell Americans you can't eat bad food. Because there has been this long-term propagation of the idea that treatment intervention is somewhat of a gift. And it isn't a gift. It's a punishment. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, we shouldn't look at having access to more prescription medicines as a gift.
No, I think life is more fun when you're healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And so we really create a problem. We increase utilization. We increase gratuitous use of treatment intervention. And at the end of the day, we continue to drive our disease process, and it's just not good for America. I know that that's a tough pill to swallow, but I tell people that the average American is more judicious about changing the oil in their car than they are about taking care of their own physiology. And the reason for that is they don't want the financial body blow of buying a new engine. And they don't worry about the financial body blow of their health problem because we believe that we have the right to have somebody intervene and fix us, even if we're destroying ourselves. And again, the studies show that 90% of disease, or that is 90% of cost, is disease that are completely lifestyle driven.
It's a painful truth, but I think we're moving in the right direction as we realize we can't pay for all the health care we need and something has to change. That's the direction it's going to go.
Yeah, but you know one thing you and I talked about earlier this morning is the fact that physicians are not given the opportunity in terms of time to really be able to help their patients through counseling and through suggestions in terms of prevention. They really want the script, right? And so the situation is they don't feel good. They want you to write them a prescription, right?
Yeah, and whether it's writing a prescription or counseling, there's no it's very well proven in our society that you can't cure obesity through a 15-minute lecture from a doctor every 3 months. It's just not the way it works. It's going to have to be a different system that incentivizes people to lose weight or to maintain a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, and I know that this doesn't probably sit as well with my conservative friends, but I do think that the government does have maybe some role there. I think that education and in some areas around public awareness, the government can do a fairly good job in some cases, but I don't think they have they do a particularly good job in intervention. It's just I haven't seen that. And look at Medicare and look at the way in which we have unbelievable fraud in Medicare. We have inefficiencies all over the place. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem like we're going to be able to fix this through more treatment intervention.
That's just an undeniable fact. And that's the bottom line. Preventing it before it happens is really the way we need to move in the future.
So right now, and we're running out of time here, but just real quickly, I know that there's some changes going on in Congress, and there's been a lot of activity about that. Can you give me the Reader's Digest version of where we are in terms of these Medicare reimbursement rates?
Well, Medicare reimbursement has been going down for years for physicians. We face a 23% cut January 1st that was put off to February 1st, then June 1st, then December 1st, and now it's being put off to January 1st again. My biggest frustration with the health care reform legislation was that it didn't fix the biggest problem we had, which was the Medicare dilemma. And if those 23% cuts go through, doctors are literally not going to be able to take care of Medicare patients. And I don't want to scare anybody by saying that, because everybody knows the system will collapse if that happens. But we really do need to talk to our congressmen and our senators and get that fixed once and for all.
Yeah, and again, I think that just sort of validates what I'm trying to tell everyone, and that is that physicians are not going to be the only ones taking the body blow. And if we continue to reduce the amount of reimbursement for everything, there in my book I talk about sicker and quicker. We're releasing people out of hospital sooner. We talk about the term disposable. Yes, there's a term in healthcare called disposable, where we're now reusing disposable surgical tools. So we're really heading down the path of a third world country. We're not going to fix this through throwing more money at it. We have to look at the root cause, and the cause is very simple. It's the disease process, and that disease process is consuming way too much treatment. Well, listen, Dr. Dan Lensink, I really appreciate you sharing the show with me today. It's a great honor to have somebody of your esteem to hang out with me and to tell this story. And I think that hopefully we've given some people a different way to look at this.
Well, I don't know if I deserve the esteem compliment, but I'll take it, and it's been fun being here. Thanks, Nick, for all you've done locally and nationally to bring this to the public awareness.
Thanks again. I'd like to thank Trudy Pratt for inviting me to come in and set in for today on Positive Health, Positively Healthy. You're listening to KCNR 1460.
It's KCNR 1460. In just a moment, Fox News Radio at the top of the hour, then it's the Nancy Sutton Pierce Show here on KCNR 1460.
I love you.